Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, June 27th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning, we have Carol Plain. Today's session number is 98-5, and it's titled Honoring the Body, Singing Our Lives, Dying Well. Let's listen in.
This is the last in a series on the practices of faith, and specifically children's books that might start conversation on those practices. And today we're going to do three of the practices, and that means we're going to kind of not get through any of them very well. But the first one is honoring the body. The second one is singing our lives, and then dying well. So those are the three practices we're going to concentrate on today. We're going to start with honoring the body. I think from the time we are children, we're never quite satisfied with this flesh that the Lord has given us. We all wish we were either bigger, taller, smaller, thinner, or didn't have a birthmark, or had our hair better, or something. And so to get children to accept who they are, I think is very important. And that none of us are perfect. It's taken me a long time to figure that out, but I know that now. But I want to start with a little poem by Nikki Grimes, this book that I've shared with you a couple of times. This one's from A Child's Heart. But listen to a little child's prayer. Heavenly Father, please help me to be the best me I know how. I'm little now, but someday I'm sure I could do something grand. I could buy a zillion acres of land and grow enough food to feed everyone. I could be the smartest person on this whole earth or somebody real famous who is worth talking about, maybe a preacher like Martin Luther King Jr. Mama says, I can be anything if I only believe. And I believe I want to be a credit to the human race. Interesting that a child would have that kind of prayer of confidence, but it's a good way to start. There is a whole series of books about Jessie Bear. Jessie Bear, What Will You Wear? Better Not Get Wet, Jessie Bear. And other things about a little bear who is content with who he is. And part of honoring the body is how we adorn ourselves, how we clothe ourselves, how we bathe ourselves, and how we present ourselves. And this is Jessie Bear. Jessie Bear, what will you wear? What will you wear in the morning? My shirt of red pulled over my head in the morning. I'll wear my pants that dance, my pants that dance in the morning. I'll wear a rose between my toes, a rose in my toes in the morning. I'll wear the sun on my legs that run, sun on the run in the morning. I'll wear the sand on my arm and hand, sand on my hand in the morning. Jessie Bear, what will you wear? What will you wear at noon? I'll wear my chair. You'll wear your chair? I'll wear my chair because I'm stuck there, stuck in my chair at noon. I'll wear carrots and peas, and a little more, please. Celery crunch and sprouts in a bunch, an apple to bite and a mustache of white, juice from a pear and rice in my hair. That's what I'll wear at noon. Then you can see what time of day it's getting to be. Jessie Bear, what will you wear? What will you wear at night? Not my shirt. It's covered with dirt. Not my pants that sat in the ants. Ants in my pants tonight. Jessie Bear, what will you wear? What will you wear at night? Water to float my bubbles and boat. I'll wear in the tub tonight. And Jessie Bear goes through the day that way. My PJs with feet and face on the seat. My blanket that's blue and plays peekaboo and hugs from you and three kisses too. That's what I'll wear tonight. Jessie Bear, what will you wear at night? Sleep in my eyes and stars in the skies. Moon on my bed and dreams in my head. That's what I'll wear tonight. So Jessie Bear. There's another one that's called Better Not Get Wet, Jessie Bear, and it's one that kids love to chime in on because that refrain repeats itself. Better not get wet, Jessie Bear. Anyway, there's a lot of books written about people who are less than perfect. And I think it's good for children to realize that none of us are perfect, and some of us have illnesses that stay. This is called Happy Birthday to You. So it's a British publication put out by Barron's, but very interesting. Just as the sun was beginning to set, Sam went for a ride on his bicycle, and in the distance, under a tall tree, he saw someone who was wearing a big straw hat. And suddenly a gust of wind snatched the hat and swept it high up into the air. Sam, to the rescue, he raced after the hat until he caught it, and then he carried it back to its owner. "Are you a boy or a girl?" Sam asked. "And why don't you have any hair?" "I'm a girl. The medicines and shots I take to get well made my hair fall out. I have a sickness called cancer. Thanks for catching my hat. What's your name?"
"My name's Sam. What's yours?"
"My name's Lily," the girl replied. And so Sam sat next to Lily. "What's cancer?" he asked. "Does it make people die?"
"Cancer's a bad sickness," Lily explained, "but I'm not afraid. If I fight it, I can get well. Sometimes, though, I wonder if I will die. That's what my mother taught me to count flower petals. She says I count them all the time. Would you like to see how I do it?"
And Lily picked a small white flower with 7 petals. As she pulled off the petals, she said, "Will not, will, will not, will not, will not." And then she smiled. "See? The last petal is will not. That means I won't die."
"It's my turn," said Sam, and picking another little flower. "Will not, will not, will not, will." He stared at the last petal. "Will? Did that stand for will die?" How strange. His counting ended one way and Lily's ended another.
"Are you afraid to die?" he asked.
"Of course. But my mother told me that children become angels when they die. If that happens, my hair will grow back again."
And Sam smiled. "Well, then you could tie it up in braids."
Lily laughed. "And what pretty hair clips I could wear." The more they talked, the happier they felt. It was fun to make new friends. And Sam said, "I know. Let's carve an angel with long hair on this tree. That way we'll always remember this day."
"No!"
As Lily jumped to her feet, her book fell from her lap. "That would hurt that tree."
Sam picked up the book and looked at it. "What's this about?" he asked.
"Will you read it to me?"
And Lily read a wonderful story about a big, tall tree. For 100 years, it had grown near a river, and one beautiful spring day, many animals came to play near the tree, and they all carved pictures in the tree's bark, all except Little Turtle. He just squatted under the tree, planting one seed after another. And the other animals laughed. "Stupid turtle," they said. And the next spring, the bear, the squirrels, and the rabbits all came to visit the tree again, and what a surprise they had. "Look, there are flowers everywhere, purple, yellow, blue, pink, hundreds of little flowers bloomed in that grass under the tree, and how beautiful they were. Pretty butterflies fluttered happily among the flowers. Look," they cried, "look what Little Turtle planted." Everyone agreed that Little Turtle had had the best idea of all, and Lily closed the book. "If you want to remember this day," she said, "don't carve pictures in the tree. Plant some pretty flowers. But it's time to go home now. Come back tomorrow, okay?"
"Okay," Sam agreed, and he waved goodbye to Lily, and then he rode home thinking about the story that she'd read. And after that, Sam often played under that tree with Lily. But one afternoon, Lily showed him a shiny new lock and key. "I call this my happy lock," she explained. "My mother gave it to me as an early birthday present because my birthday is 1 week from today. She told me to hang the lock on this big tree, and then the tree would protect me and bring me good luck. You see, tomorrow I'm going back to the hospital. But if I take the medicines and shots, I'll be back to open the lock."
"I'll help you," Sam said, and he climbed into the big tree and reaching out very carefully, he hung the happy lock on a branch,
and after climbing down, he closed his eyes and wished that Lily would get well. Lily put the key into her pocket. "Thank you, Sam," she exclaimed, and the friends laughed together.
"I know," Sam said as the stars began to shine in the sky. "I'll give you a birthday cake."
"Where will you get the money?" asked Lily.
"I don't need money.
My mother taught me how to make a cake in the sky. You can't eat it, but you can make a wish and blow out the candles. I'll show you on your birthday. Lily's eyes glowed with excitement. Good, we'll come here on my birthday and make wishes. And we'll open the happy lock, Sam added.
Yes, agreed Lily. Let's both promise.
And the days passed. 2, 3, 4, 5. Sam couldn't wait for Lily's birthday. At last the big day came. And Sam went to the tree to wait for his friend. And he waited, and he waited. But Lily never came. And when it started to get dark, Sam knew it was time to go home. But there was something he had to do first. Picking a flower, he pulled off the petals, counting softly to himself. Will not. Will not. Will not. Will. Oh, good. The last petal was will. That must mean that Lily will be back, he thought. Maybe she'll be back tomorrow. But today was Lily's birthday. What could he do to celebrate? So Sam stretched out his hands to make a circle as round as a birthday cake. Several fireflies fluttered around the tips of his fingers, and they almost looked like lighted candles. And Sam made a wish for Lily. And then he blew the candles as hard as he could so his wish would come true. And as the fireflies fluttered away, Sam knew he would get his wish. And quietly he whispered, Lily, happy birthday to you. And that's at the last page. It even tells kids how they can count by saying will not. Honoring our bodies does not mean we're going to be free of illness or of sadness or of sorrow. One of these stories, I'm not going to read this one to you, but Abuela's Weave is about a little girl named Esperanza in Guatemala. Her abuela, or her grandmother, teaches her how to loom wonderful, wonderful things. And on the loom, she weaves all these great things. But Abuela has a very disfiguring birthmark on her face. And children have called her a witch because she has this birthmark. And they say, oh, don't go around her. She'll put a spell on you. So when Esperanza and Abuela weave together and decide to try to go sell their things in the market, as many people in Guatemala do, Abuela says, Esperanza, sit by yourself. Don't even act like you know me. And she takes a hood and covers her face so that no one sees her birthmark. And so little Esperanza has to go into the city with Abuela 3 paces behind or a half a block behind because she's afraid she will put the spell and Esperanza won't be able to sell her things. And so Abuela stays in the background. And as Esperanza puts all of her wares out for everybody to see, they think they're wonderful. Because next to all the stalls are these manufactured things with built-in zippers and things, and all of hers are homemade. And finally, Abuela, after everything is sold, comes out and takes her hood off. And on the way home, it's a very interesting last page, it says, and on the way back to Santa Cruz, grandmother and granddaughter sit side by side, and Esperanza's smooth and nimble fingers held tightly, and Abuela's wrinkled old hands. But I think it's an interesting story of accepting ourselves when something can be very disfiguring and very noticeable. But to honor our bodies, we also must accept those kind of things as well. This book was just given to me by someone here at Holden, and I haven't seen this before. A friend just gave this to me. It says, my child, you are a gift from God. And it tells just a short story, but it gives a scripture passage for each one, which I thought was kind of an interesting way to present it. My child, you are unique in your own way, amazing me with the things you do and say. And then it says, you are the one who put me together inside my mother's body, and I praise you because of the wonderful way you created me. And throughout the story, it just tells how wonderful and special this child is, and then gives a scripture verse to underline that. It's called A Gift from God, My Child You Are. Finally, one that I just want to point out, too. This is called I Love My Hair. If you're a little African-American girl, you know that hair can either be a detriment or something that people praise. And these days in the school, sometimes these girls come with 300 little tiny braids that must take them hours to put it in their hair, and they look wonderful. But sometimes their hair can be a real problem. And this little girl just hates to have her mother fix her hair. And her mother says, oh, you're so fortunate. You have such beautiful hair. You can wear it any way you want to. And this is a story of a little girl accepting her hair, even though at first she thinks it's a pain to have this kind of hair. But it's a good story of accepting the way God made us. You know, none of us got the hair we did by choice either. So neither does a little black girl. Okay, I'm going to skip down to dime. And the reason I'm going to do that is because I think singing is what we have left. Because so far the Lord's left you and me here. So we're going to do a little thing on dying first. This is a book that's in the bookstore called The Cherry Blossom Tree. It's about a grandfather who is getting older. And his granddaughter who comes to visit him said, you are getting older, are you going to die? And, you know, that's a typical child question. That's not anything out of the ordinary. Are you going to die? And he says, yes, someday. I don't know when. But he said, let's just try something once. And he takes a cherry pit that has fallen down, and he says, you know what? Look at what happened to this cherry pit, because it has broken open, and a little tiny seedling has started coming. And he says, see, even after death, there's new life. And it's kind of like a treatise on eternal life and what happens after we die. And I think it's very well done. Put out by Augsburg, by the way, The Cherry Blossom Tree. This book was written by Carmen Agraditi. It's called The Last Dance. And I think it's a very interesting story of somebody who learns to accept death. And it also, in her introduction or in her dedication, she uses Romans 12:6 as kind of a introduction. Ninny would throw buttons at my window. His grandfather was a tailor. On nights when the moon sat full-bellied on the treetops beyond the graveyard, Ninny would leap over the stone and mortar that was the orchard wall between our houses, and reaching into his pockets, he would throw his grandfather's buttons at my window pane until my face, round and pale as the moon, would appear. And sometimes, as he looked up at me, he would sing the graveyard song because he knew it gave me the willies. I was afraid of the graveyard. I wasn't brave like Ninny. But I can still hear his merry voice ringing out like a chapel bell. Bessie, oh, Bessie, come dance with me, for I hate to dance alone, where the old men sleep and the women weep and the wild fay children roam. I, in my nightgown full of stars, shivered with delight as I shimmied down the drain pipe to meet Ninny. He, in his pajamas of a bilious green, waited below, grinning wickedly and clutching his grandfather's pipe. To the graveyard we would go, and Ninny's grandfather, Opa, slept there, row 7, grave 3. And Ninny never feared the graveyard. He said, any place that Opa sleeps is a good place. Under a fleet of stars, Ninny would dance and play his pipe, and I would waltz with shadows and sing. And then we would tell stories about Opa. When Opa was alive, we used to walk the path with him to the graveyard to visit Nana, his wife. And once, when Ninny made fun of my squeaky voice, I laughed at the funny way he danced. And that night, Opa taught us that every human being has the right to 3 things. To dance. The great thing in life is not so much to dance well, but whether one is willing to dance at all. To sing, even if you sing off key. The crow has as much right to a voice as the nightingale. And to tell stories. Those we love are never really gone as long as their stories are told. Now, after Opal was gone, Ninny and I would often slip away to visit him at the graveyard. And on one of those milk moon nights, Ninny put down his pipe and he began to dance a jig for Opa. He was as wild and beautiful thing to watch as his lanky body cast moon shadows across crooked gravestones. And when he dropped exhausted at my feet, I knelt next to him and I whispered, Ninny, when I die, I want you to come to the graveyard and dance on my grave. Oh, yes, he said, breathless, but you must promise to do the same for me. And having struck a bargain, we crossed our hearts and we spit, and then we shook hands. Now, after Ninny and I were married, he was sent off to war. It seemed like the country even needed tailors like my young husband. And I missed him dreadfully. I was afraid of the war.
I wasn't brave like Ninny.
One evening, I picked up his needle and tried to remember how he worked the small, even stitches that he had learned from Opa. I had to work hard at what came so easily to Ninny, but I knew I was not alone, because across England, women had picked up not only needles, but hammers, and bandages, and plow rings, too.
D-Day was a surprise. The Normandy invasion was a secret, and as news broke out of the Allied landing, I grew worried.
It had been weeks since a letter had arrived from Minnie, and each night I sat on the worn wooden steps that led to the garden, waiting. And from there I watched our son Edward roll up in the moonlight, and beyond him, past the fields of barley and rye, lay the graveyard. I sang softly as I watched the stars watching Ninny. Ninny, oh Ninny, come dance with me, for I'd hate to dance alone, where the old men sleep and the women weep and the wild fey children roam. Many men died at Normandy. No one knew the fate of their husbands or fathers or sons, and for days the wind was filled with the voices of 1,000 women. Women who feared the graveyard just like me. Each day, I listened for the sound of buttons against my windowpane telling me that Minnie was alive and home safely. Instead, it was old McKinney's bicycle wheels crunching the gravel that brought me word of Minnie. Coming home, stop. Put on dancing shoes, stop. Love you always, never stop. Bessie, oh Bessie, come dance with me. For I hate to dance alone where the old men sleep and the women weep and the wild fey children roam. Ninny was dancing with a dish rag as I cleared sticky tea cakes from their trays. No time for dancing tonight, Ninny boy. This party is for us. It was our anniversary, and all the children had come to celebrate.
Well, then, who else but us should be dancing?
Laughed Ninny. Look, Bessie. It's just like our song, and we peeked into the parlor, and there was old Uncle Wendell, snoring in Ninny's favorite armchair amid a roving band of grandchildren. And Edward's wife, Dee Dee, was crying into her kerchief, saying, "It's beautiful, Edward. Isn't it beautiful?" It was just like our song.
"Dance with me, Bessie," whispered Ninny.
I nodded and closed my eyes, and then his arm circled my waist, and we slipped out into the garden.
My dear old Ninny seemed almost spry.
It was an enchanted night, like thousands I'd spent with Ninny. Not once did our feet stumble.
I never missed a step. Open your eyes, Bessie.
Ninny had stopped dancing and was looking toward the graveyard. And there stood Opa's gravestone bathed in moonlight, and he was still watching over us.
And I just looked at Ninny with wonder.
I think Opa would have had a grand time tonight, Ninny, I said softly.
What makes you think he isn't?
He grinned. Our feet moved like old friends as we began to dance again, and Ninny leaned close and said, "When it's time, Bessie, remember our promise to each other and save the last dance for me." I'm an old woman now, and on nights, when the moon sits full-bellied on the treetops, I'm reminded that I have a promise to keep. I no longer fear the graveyard. Any place my Ninny sleeps is a good place. The Last Dance.
And I want to share with you, and I have to start this by saying, Barbara Park happens to be one of my favorite authors. She wrote the book Mick Hart Was Here. And since we have a child here, I'll have to, when we get to one part, I have to kind of excuse it. Okay. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about this story, because we can't, of course, read the whole thing. Just let me say right off the bat, it was a bike accident. It was about as accidental as you can get, too. Like, Mick wasn't riding crazy or dodging in and out of traffic, and both of his hands were on the handlebars and all like that. His tire just hit a rock, and he skidded into the back of a passing truck, and that was that. There wasn't a scratch on him. It was a head injury, period. So this isn't the kind of book where you meet the main character and you get to like him real well and then he dies at the end. I hate those kind of books. And besides, I can't think of anything worse than using my brother's accident as the tear-jerking climax of some tragic story. I just don't want to make you cry. But I just want to tell you about Mick. But I thought you should know right up front that he's not here anymore. I just thought that would be fair. I'm only 10 months older than he is. I was planned. Mick was a surprise. He loved it, too, being a surprise. I mean, he was always teasing my parents about it, telling them that even before he existed, he could outsmart two chemistry majors with birth control pills. Just imagine the amazing stunts I'll pull when I'm a sneaky, rebellious teenager, he'd say. And then he'd rub his hands together and throw his head back and do that kind of creepy laugh that mad scientists do in the movies, you know, like, mwah-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha. And he'd hunch over and limp out of the room like Igor or something. Mick was excellent at imitating voices, by the way. We have a tape of him yelling, "I'm melting! I'm melting!" that sounds just like the Wicked Witch of the West and the Wizard of Oz. Exactly, I mean. But even without playing the tape, I can still remember how he sounded. I've heard that sometimes when people you love die, you forget their voices, but I haven't forgotten Mick's. Not yet, anyway. I have a weird kind of memory, I think. Now, one time, and I think of Susan Briel, who once told me that this was a word that she could never use in her house, but Martin Luther used it, and it's spelled F-A-R-T, so just so you know it's coming. Okay. All right, the last morning that they had together, she and Mick had a fight. And Mick had asked her to take his bicycle home, and she said she couldn't because she had practice. But she then thinks back to something that happened in their childhood. It kills me when I remember that last morning together because usually I hardly cuss at all, but she'd called him a name. It doesn't say what name, but it says a name that she'd heard on HBO. At least I don't cuss as much as most kids my own age, I don't think. Mick didn't either, which is almost weird for a seventh grade boy. Not that the two of us were angels or anything. I'm not saying that, but we were always getting in trouble. But normally it was for stuff we did together, as a team. Because even though it sounds corny and all, when we weren't fighting, my brother and I actually liked each other a lot. I think it was the result of being so close in age. Like when Mick was learning to talk, I was the only one who could understand him. So I sort of became his translator. I mean, right from the beginning, I knew that truck meant dog, and that memaflusit meant that he wanted to flush the toilet. Now, the first big caper we pulled together was right after Mick started kindergarten. That was when we decided to deface our first property. To be specific, we scratched the letters F-A-R-T in the new driveway that had just been poured next to our home. Now, we didn't do it to be bad. It's just that I was learning how to spell. And Mick was learning how to print. And the cement just sort of called to us, I guess you'd say. Now, Mick promised that I would tell him the right letters and he could do a good job with his printing. And he did too. I mean, his R was backward, but at the time, neither of us knew the difference. All I remember is how excited we were when we were finished. We clapped and we jumped up and down and we just totally laughed our heads off. Without a doubt, that was the funniest thing anyone had ever done in the entire history of the universe. It's amazing how a little fart in the driveway can totally lose its humor when your father sees it. Now, I really don't want to go into all the details of what happened when he discovered it that night, but I will tell you that when he and Mom stood up in front of us and made us solemnly swear to tell the complete and honest truth about how it got there, Mick swallowed hard, took a big step forward, and told them, "A monkey did it." Seriously, he said that. The trouble was, I had to back him up on it. Now, I didn't really have a choice, you know? So I stood there, and I swore that we had both seen a monkey run into the driveway with a little stick in his hand and write F-A-R-T in the concrete. And then, just to make the story even more believable, Mick said the monkey's name was Zippy. And the two of us had saved the day by chasing him all the way back to Africa. Now, we ended up going to our rooms for a week or something, I think. But after a while, it became one of those things that everyone looks back on and laughs about. Like, even on the morning of the fight, when I went out the door and saw that backward R in the cement, I smiled just a little bit. I didn't want to, but I did. Now, she goes on in this book to tell you how what happened and how Mick was just riding, and then she heard sirens while she was at track practice. Didn't know it was for Mick, who had hit the rock and hit the thing. And then how her dad had come in and said, "He's gone." And what that did to her life when she discovered that her brother had died. And she goes through this story telling about the things Mick did because she just wants you to know that Mick Hart had been here. And she goes with a very guilty conscience because she keeps thinking, if only I had said I would ride his bicycle home, Mick would still be here. And she goes on and on about this. And then I want to tell you what happens with her father. And the reason I read the part about the little driveway episode is because the ending of the story goes back to that. They had an assembly at school to remember Mick, a memorial service. I don't know if what I said at that assembly will make a difference. I don't know if it will help anyone use better judgment than my brother did. I hope so, though. Honest to God, I do, because Mick died from a massive head injury. And yet the doctors said that just an inch of styrofoam would have made the difference between his living and dying. He didn't have a helmet on. It's been a month since the accident now. Things have gotten a little better at home. Nana from Florida went back to Orlando. And my mother does get dressed in the morning now, usually. She's gone back to work, too, just 2 days a week, but it's a start. We sit down to dinner every night at our new places. Eating still isn't a big deal with us, though. Like last night, we had grilled cheese sandwiches and mashed potatoes. And on Sunday, all the forks were in the dishwasher, so we ate potato salad with soup spoons. My mother's eased up on stuff like that. Death sort of gives you a new outlook on the importance of proper silverware. It's called perspective. It means your father doesn't iron a crease in his pants every morning. And the hamburgers come in all shapes and sizes. I've started to laugh more often, but I still feel guilty when I'm having too good a time. Which is totally ridiculous, because if I want to feel guilty, there's lots better reasons to do it than that. Like, I'm just now starting to deal with how Mick asked me to ride his bike home that day and all. I kept that whole memory tucked away in the back of my mind after the accident happened, but bad memories must grow in the dark, I think, because it kept on creeping into my thoughts till it was with me almost all the time, it seemed. And then last Saturday, when my father and I were riding home from a soccer game, my stomach started churning like it always does right before I'm about to blurt out an unplanned confession. It's one of the sickest feelings there is, by the way, to realize you're about to squeal on yourself like that. The only thing sicker is keeping it inside. So it all came bursting out about how Mick asked me to ride his bike that day and how I had soccer practice, so I told him I couldn't do it. See, Pop, don't you get it? I could have kept that accident from ever happening. If only I'd ridden his bike home, Mick would still be right here now. And I was crying a little bit now. But except for handing me the travel tissues from the dashboard, my father hardly seemed to notice. Instead, he just kept staring out the window at the road in front of us. And then slowly, he began shaking his head from side to side. "Sorry, Pop. I'm sorry, I'm sorry," I said over and over again. And my face was buried in my hands when I finally felt him touch my shoulder. "I'm going to make a list, Phoebe," he said, "and I want you to keep a count." And his voice was real low and steady as he began. "If only you had ridden Mick's bike home, Mick would still be here. If only the truck had been going a little faster or a little slower, Mick would still be here. If only his meeting had been scheduled one day earlier or one day later, Mick would still be here. If only it had been raining that day, I'd have driven him to school, and Mick would still be here. If only one of his friends had kept him talking a second longer at his locker that afternoon. If only the house he was riding to had been in the other direction. If only that rock hadn't been on the sidewalk at that exact spot." And he stopped then. I was pretty sure he was finished, but all at once,
He heaved this god-awful sigh and whispered, "If only I had made him wear his helmet." And my heart broke for my father at that moment, and I reached my hand out to him, and he held on to it tight. And then he smiled the saddest smile you've ever seen. "What number are we on, little girl?" He sounded so old. And I scooted closer to him. "I think we're done, Pop," I said softly. And he pressed my hand to his cheek, and the two of us drove home in silence. Now, yesterday was the official 1-month anniversary of the accident, and I used to think that anniversaries only celebrated happy things, but now I know that they're just a way of measuring time. I went to soccer practice after school, and I didn't feel much like running, though, and Coach Brody must have sensed something was wrong because she didn't push me or yell at me for dogging it like she usually does. And the weird thing is, after practice was over, I didn't want to leave the field. All I wanted to do was sit on the sidelines by myself for a while and think about Mick. Sounds depressing, but it wasn't. I mean, there were lots of good memories of Mick in that field, too. Living so close to school, we used to go down there all the time and kick the soccer ball around or throw the frisbee or something. And a couple of months ago, we even tried playing polo on our bikes using my father's golf clubs. Wasn't that much fun, though. I kept hitting myself in the foot with the sand wedge, and Mick kept getting the putter caught in his pants. I grinned at the memory, and I sat down in the grass. And unfortunately, right across the field from me, a group of noisy workmen were banging around, putting in a new set of permanent bleachers. They were setting them in concrete. So it was pretty clear they were going to be working there for a while. Even so, I decided to wait them out. It's another talent of mine. I guess you'd say, in addition to staring you down, I can also wait you out. It was almost dark when they finally went home. Still can't believe no one stayed behind to guard that new sidewalk they just poured. I mean, you gotta be nuts leaving wet cement unguarded at a junior high school. Especially if there's an 8th grade girl sitting across the field who's been watching you all afternoon. And she's already spotted a little stick lying in the grass next to her hand, which was totally weird, by the way. I mean, because there's not a tree anywhere near the soccer field, not even in sight, I mean, and yet there was a stick. It can give you the shivers if you think about it too much. The stick was just the perfect size, too. Small enough to do a neat job, but still strong enough to carve the letters deep in the concrete so they would be there forever. That's what's so great about cement, you know, the forever part of me. I was totally calm when I did it. I just walked over and I bent down and I printed the letters large and neat and clear as they could be. Mick Hart was here. And I stood up and I looked at it and I smiled. Mick Hart was here. And now he's gone. But for 12 years and 5 months, my brother was one of the neatest kids you'd ever want to meet. And I just wanted to tell you about him. That's all. I just thought you ought to know. Mick Hart Was Here by Barbara Park. Interesting story of what life is like for those left behind, especially when a young person is involved. But for some reason, the Lord has left us behind too for now. And so we got to keep on living. And he's asked us to sing along the way. What an inspiration to hear Soul Purpose last night, both in spreading the gospel through song and their acting. What a blessing. And the Lord has asked us to celebrate too and to sing along the way and not to give up and not to be down all the time, even though the world's going to hell in a handbasket. He still asks us to celebrate, and we need to do that. And a couple of stories that help us celebrate. One of them is called The Old Man Who Loved to Sing. Now, this story was written by an Australian. And so you're going to see some animals in here that you and I don't know, but that's okay. In a secluded valley far from the city lived an old man who loved to sing. Now, when he wasn't singing, he whistled. And when he wasn't whistling, he played music on an old wind-up gramophone. And he usually did all three very, very loudly. Now, the old man had once lived in the city,
But there came a time when he could no longer hear himself sing above the noise. At first, the unfamiliar sounds of his music echoing through the valley disturbed the animals. But soon they came to love the music. And at night, when the old man fell asleep in his armchair, the animals would gather around his campfire. And as the years passed, the old man grew forgetful, as people sometimes do, much to the delight of the sparrows. And the wombats, and the possum. And sometimes he forgot to eat his lunch, but it never went to waste. One day, he forgot to sing. He forgot to whistle. He even forgot to play music on the old wind-up gramophone. The old man knew something was missing, but he couldn't remember what it was. Without the sound of the old man's music, the valley became silent. The kangaroos, disturbed by the silence, began to beat their tails softly in the dust. And the sound of their drumming carried down to the creek where the frogs joined in with loud, throaty croaks. And the birds heard their call and burst into song. And soon, the valley echoed with singing. But the loudest song of all came from the old man. Now, if we don't sing, the song may be lost unless we pass it on to somebody else who can remind us again to sing. Maybe that's the meaning of community. We need to encourage one another to sing our song, whatever that song may be. And not all of us are great singers. One of the one of the books I didn't bring, The Singing Man by Angela Shelf Medeiros, is an African folk tale about three brothers. It's a typical folk tale involving three brothers, all of whom choose their life work, and one of them says he wants to be a singing man. Well, his father thinks that's the craziest idea he's ever come up with, because he wants him to get a job, thank you. But the young boy insists that he is called to be a singing man. And so he leaves and wanders for a number of years before he comes back and finally is satisfied, and his father is satisfied, that indeed he was meant to be a singing man. And it's an interesting folk tale, the idea of singing, and that sometimes those people who are celebratory in their lives, people kind of say, why don't you get a job or something else, and don't really believe you can do both. And so this is a good story of that. The other one that I want to share with you is one of Bird Baylor's books, again, one of my favorite authors. Some of us can't sing, but we can celebrate. And celebration is a form of song and praise to God, I think, too. So if we don't feel that we are the world's best singers, then we can celebrate in other ways and still enjoy this. And this is about a young girl, again, in the Southwest, where Bird Baylor lives, too, that really shows us how to live our life as a life of song and praise to God. Sometimes people ask me, aren't you lonely out there with just that desert around you? I guess they mean the bear grass and the yuccas and the cactus and the rocks. I guess they mean the deep ravines and the hawk nests and the cliffs and the coyote trails that wind across the hills. Lonely? I can't help laughing when they ask me that. I always look at them in surprise and I say, how could I be lonely? I'm the one in charge of celebrations. Now, sometimes they don't believe me, but it's true, I am. I put myself in charge. I choose my own. Last year, I gave myself 108 celebrations, besides the ones that they closed school for. I cannot get by with only a few. Friend, I'll tell you how it works. I keep a notebook, and I write the date, and then I write about the celebration. I'm very choosy over what goes in that book. It has to be something I plan to remember the rest of my life. You can tell
because your heart will pound and you'll feel like you're standing on top of a mountain and you'll catch your breath like you were breathing some new kind of air. Otherwise, I count it just an average day. I told you I was choosy. Friend, I wish you'd been there for Dust Devil Day. But since you weren't, I'll tell you how it got to be my first real celebration. You can call them whirlwinds if you want to. Me, I think Dust Devils has a better sound. Well, anyway, I always stop to watch them. Here, everyone does. You know how they come from far away, moving up from the flats, swirling and swaying and falling and turning and picking up sticks and sand and feathers and even tumbleweeds? Well, last March 11th, we were all going somewhere, and I was in the back of a pickup truck when the Dust Devils started to gather. And you could see they were giants, and you'd swear they were calling their friends to come, too. And they came dancing in time to their own wind music. We all started counting, and we all started looking for more. And they stopped that truck, and we turned around and around watching them all. There were seven. At a time like that, something kind of goes crazy in you. You have to run to meet them yelling all the way. And you have to whirl around like you were one of them, and you can't stop until you're falling down. And then all day, you think how lucky you were to be there. Now, some of my best celebrations are sudden surprises like that. If you weren't outside at that exact moment, you'd miss them. I spend a lot of time outside myself, looking around. And once, I saw a triple rainbow that ended in a canyon where I'd been the day before, and I was halfway up a hill, standing in a drizzle of rain, and it was almost dark. But I wouldn't go in because of the rainbows, of course. And there on the top of the hill, a jackrabbit was standing, up on his hind legs, perfectly still, looking straight at that same triple rainbow. And I may be the only person in the world who's seen a rabbit standing in the mist, quietly watching three rainbows. That's worth a celebration anytime. I wrote it down and drew the hill and the rabbit and the rainbow and me. And now, August 9th, is Rainbow Celebration Day. Now, I have Green Cloud Day, too. Ask anybody, and they'll tell you clouds aren't green. But late one winter afternoon, I saw this huge green cloud. It was not bluish green or grayish green or something else. This cloud was green. Green is a jungle parrot. And the strange thing was that it began to take a parrot shape, first the wings, and then the head and beak, and high in the winter sky, that green bird flew. It didn't last more than a minute. You know how fast a cloud can change? But I still remember how it looked. So I celebrate green clouds on February 6th. At times like that, I always think, what if I'd missed it? What if I'd been in the house, or that if I didn't look up when I did? You can see I'm very lucky about things like that. And I was lucky on Coyote Day because out of all time, it had to be one moment only that a certain coyote and I could meet. And we did. Friend, you should have been there too. I was following deer tracks, just taking my time, bending down as I walked, kind of humming. I hum a lot when I'm alone. And I looked up in time to see a young coyote trotting through the bush. And she crossed in front of me, and it was a windy day, and she was going east. And in that easy, silent way coyotes move, she pushed into the wind. And I stood there hardly breathing, wishing I could move that way. I was surprised to see her stop and turn and look at me. She seemed to think that I was just another creature following another rocky trail. That's true, of course, I am. But she didn't hurry, and she wasn't afraid. And I saw her eyes, and she saw mine. And that look held us together. Because of that, I never will feel quite the same again. So on September 28th, I celebrate Coyote Day. Here's what I do. I walk the trail I walked that day, and I hum softly as I go. And finally, I unwrap the feast I've brought for her. And last time, it was three apples and some pumpkin seeds and an ear of corn and some big, soft, homemade ginger cookies. And the next day, I happened to pass that way again, and coyote tracks went all around the rock where the food had been, and the food was gone. Next year, I'll make it even better. I'll bring an extra feast, and I'll eat there, too. Another one of my greatest of all celebrations is called the Time of Falling Stars. It lasts almost a week in the middle of August, and I wait all year for those hot summer nights when the sky goes wild. You can call them meteor showers if you want to. Me, I like to say they're falling stars. All that week I sleep outside and I give my full attention to the sky, and every time a streak of light goes shooting through the darkness, I feel my heart shoot out of me. One night, I saw a fireball that left a long red blazing trail across the sky, and after it was gone, I stood there looking up, not quite believing what I'd seen. And the strange thing was, I met a man who told me he had seen it too while he was lying by a campfire 500 miles away. He said he didn't sleep again that night. And suddenly, it seemed that we two spoke a language no one else could understand. Every August of my life, I think of that. Friend, I've saved my New Year's celebration until last. Mine's a little different from the one most people have. It comes in the spring. To tell the truth, I never did feel like my New Year started January 1st. To me, that's just another winter day. I let my year begin when winter ends and morning light comes earlier the way it should. That's when I feel like starting new. I wait until the white-winged doves are back from Mexico and wildflowers cover the hills and my favorite cactus blooms. And it always makes me think I should bloom myself. And that's when I start to plan my New Year's celebration. I finally choose a day that's exactly right. Even the air has to be perfect and the dirt has to feel good and warm on bare feet. Usually it's a Saturday around the end of April. And I have a drum that I beat to signal the day. And then I go wandering off, following all of my favorite trails to all of the places I like, and I check how everything's doing. And I check very well, and I spend the day just admiring things. And if the old desert tortoise I know from last year's out strolling around, I'll go his direction for a while. And I celebrate with horned toads and ravens and lizards and quail. And friend, it's not a bad party. Walking back home, kind of humming sometimes, I think about those people who ask me if I'm lonely here. I have to laugh out loud. I'm in charge of celebration. So if we can't fit anybody else's in, make your own and sing with your heart. I think God calls us to be celebratory people. And I think he calls us for praise even in the days when we don't feel like it. So if we can't sing our song, dance our dance. And if we can't dance our dance, then just praise him in some way we can by making our own celebrations. Okay, before we go, anybody have any books or comments on how we could teach children to honor the body, to sing, or to die well? Yes.
This is a story, my favorite thing about Barney.
Yes, yes, by Judith Bjorst. Yes.
It talks about a cat.
Yes.
And how a child deals with that.
And she lists 10 good things about Barney that she remembers. It's a great story, especially for children who have lost a pet. Great way to share with them. It's by Judith Bjorst, who does some good work. Good, thank you. Any others that you know or that just comments? Yes.
One of my favorites is called And God Created
Oh, I like the title.
It's a story of the creation, but it's got good humor and very joyful.
Good. And God Created Squash. Isn't that a wonderful title? People can think of such great titles. I'm always just amazed. Thank you. By Hickman, you said?
Hickman.
God Created Squash. Oh, I like that. Dennis Cazette, who's done a lot of good work. In fact, this has nothing to do with the dying or singing, but one of my favorite books he wrote is about a little animal child who goes to kindergarten, and she decides that kindergarten, you know, they learn to do things like sticking straws in their noses and blowing milk through it, and her mother asks at the end of the day, how did kindergarten go, and the mother keeps reaching for a cookie, and the little animal child says, but you're going on a diet. And so she puts her hand back, and he tells her about the things like that they found out that the principal sleeps behind the door, and that all these things, all these little animals in kindergarten are having this great time. And this one little kid comes up to the teacher, and the other day says, I think I'd like to go home now. in the middle of the day. But Dennis Cazette writes some great books. But he wrote one called Fish in His Pocket, which is about on his way to school, he finds a little dead fish, and he doesn't know what to do. You know, what do you do with a dead fish? Sometimes mothers flush them down the toilet, but you don't tell them that. And but he builds a little boat, and he puts the fish in his paper boat that he's made out of a piece of paper that he has in his backpack, and he floats that little dead fish down the river. And I think it's such a tender way to tell about, you know, when you're talking about creation and that all of creation belongs to God, what a nice way to send a fish to its final resting place in a little paper boat, you know? Dennis Cazette does that. Yes, thank you.
Carol, what's your opinion is of the Berenstain Bear books? They have so reversed the mother, Mama, is so strong that the mm-hmm. Papa's always bumbling and fumbling and... Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I think kids go through a Berenstain Bear book space in their life. My only concern about Berenstain Bears is I think they've got a formula and they've overrun it. You know, they just keep producing more Berenstain Bear books and more Berenstain Bear books. And it's kind of like, that's what I think about the Big Red Dog books by Bridwell, too. I mean, I think they're fine, but I think they could have quit maybe three books ago or something. I mean, it's like they keep producing and producing and producing, and it's some of them are good and they're of varying quality. But I think that I think you're right. The family configuration sometimes are a little strange. Whereas Frank Ash has written that wonderful book about Just Like Daddy, about a family that goes fishing, and this little kid says he learns how to fish how to bait his hook just like Daddy, and he learns how to throw the pole just like Daddy, and he goes through this whole thing just like Daddy, and then at the end he says, and I catch a fish, and the last page is just like Mommy, which I think is a great surprise ending. Frank Ash has done that, you know, which I think is cute. But I agree. Go ahead.
It's called The Hurt, and it's by Paul's Press. I can't think of the author. It's very small. Mm. It's about a little boy and his dad. And the hurt is actually, the little boy has hurt feelings. And the hurt is made into a thing.
Oh.
That he can, he's just beautiful.
Oh, no, I'm not familiar with that. The hurt.
How he talks about the hurt, and then it gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
Oh, yeah.
Is that by?
She said it's from Paulus Press. Do you know the author? Or is,
I can't think
you
of
can't.
The author's name.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. Any others that anybody knows or any comments? And how do you teach children to honor their bodies? How do we raise children who are content with the body God gave them? We have a little girl. One of our adopted children is from Vietnam. And we got her when she was 5. And she had spent her life in Vietnam on her rear end and her knees. She had polio. And as the first surgeon who did surgery on her said, Vietnamese girls are not worth much, but crippled Vietnamese girls are worth nothing. He had worked in hospital Ship Hope. So when she came to us, she had callous knees because she had spent her life in the orphanage crawling around, and they had propped her up once on a thing. Well, after we had gotten her, we got her in February, and May, the first surgery they did tried to turn her foot had gotten backwards, and her leg is completely useless because all the muscles have atrophied. And they had tried to turn her foot, and they put her in a brace. And she started going to school in Tacoma after we had adopted her. And the second year we had her, we have to fill out these federal forms. I don't know how, if you have to do that. If you have military installations around you, you have to say whether the person's in the military. And there were, on the back it says, is your child handicapped? And is this in a handicapped program? And at that time she was. They were trying to do therapy with her, which they gave up on because all the muscles had atrophied. And I had checked that, and she was at that time 7, and she looked at me and she said, am I handicapped? And it was such a wonderful moment. And we said, oh no, not really, just your leg doesn't work right. But it was like, you know, what does that mean? And I think she has become quite content. She only one time in high school, she said, I wish I could wear high heels like other people. She wears a built-up shoe, both inside and outside. And I think those moments are very hard for teenagers. But I think she now will turn 30, is content with the body that she has. And she knows that that's the body she has. But I think it's, you know, we have to encourage children to accept who they are. I mean,
There's no reason for her to have had polio in Vietnam. The cure was already there, but she was in the wrong place at the wrong time and didn't get the vaccine, which could have prevented that. So I think then we live with the consequences and hope they can accept themselves for who they are.
Yes?
I also think this doesn't have to do with books either. We need the model accepting our own body.
Yes.
I don't think our society rejects that image at all.
No.
So it takes great effort on the part of parents and family and church.
Yes. Yes. I think you're absolutely right.
Every once in a while, though, don't you just kind of go like this?
Yes.
Get those wrinkles out of there.
Oh.
just once in a while.
Okay. I used to use this illustration when I led the nature walks, you know, and the young trees are smooth just like young kids.
Yes.
And when we got to the big cottonwoods, I mean, they're really rough. And I always talked about, well, we all like to have the smooth faces, but when you get to where you're older, and you're getting like the bark of that cottonwood tree that's just rough.
Yes.
There's Helen Hayes, I think, that quoted it. It says, don't apologize for those wrinkles. Those are your merit badges. And
yes, yes.
That gave me great comfort.
That's right, that's right. I figure this is six kids, you know.
I also want to know, so many four-year-old kids love the dinosaurs.
Yes, they do.
Do you know why? I mean, it's not just my own, but
no,
lots of children.
They do.
At the age of four, and is it power? Is it bigness? Or what?
No, I think it's wonder at something that could be that big. I mean, I think children have a sense of awe when they think of dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Ooh, they lived so long ago. Ooh, they were so big. Yeah,
yeah,
they know more about them than you and I do.
Okay.
And they're fascinated, especially if they can see what the bones look like, you know, when they put the bones together. I think it's actually a fascination with something that is bigger than they are and that had been around a long time before they were. And I think it's a very natural fascination. And they come back to that when they're about in the second grade. And they all want to read books about dinosaurs. You know, they just check out anything.
Yeah.
It's wonderful, really. I mean, it's a great introduction into nonfiction, I figure.
Take those books.
Yeah.
I have a Down syndrome grandchild.
Yes.
And she was home to visit me in March. And I hadn't seen her for 3 years. She lived in Sweden. And I couldn't believe the development of this girl. And she knew all her letters of the alphabet. She could count. She could sing on pitch. And her favorite book was a telephone directory.
Oh.
It's big, you know, the city one. And I think we went through it 20 times. And I thought,
did you?
Why do you want to read the telephone?
Yeah.
Well, it was turning the pages. A.
Yes.
B.
Yes.
C. And he went over and over. It was something she could do.
But see, isn't that wonderful?
Oh.
Isn't that wonderful?
Good.
Yes.
Right?
Well, in this tape now. But I was just going to... I think that it shows, we have two classes, in my school where I am now, we have two classes of extremely handicapped children, none of whom are verbal, all of whom are in wheelchairs, some of whom have to be suctioned, I mean they have a nurse that comes to the library with them to suction them out during library and so on. But if I said it's like doing a horse and pony show, I mean you don't know if they understand anything, but I will take, for instance, I do a lot with stuffed animals and things with them, and if you just rub their cheek sometimes, there's a smile. So I know that something gets through to children, even those who are extremely handicapped. And years ago, I was at a school that had autistic children. And this little kid, and I mean, some of those kids, you know, hit themselves and pinch themselves, and one of them talked only in vowels. Now tell me how your mind does that. But he would go, and his teacher started understanding him. He used no consonants. Now how? I mean, I couldn't even figure out how to do that, but he did that. He also pinched people real hard. I mean, that was just a sideline. But when I had a little kid who hadn't said anything all year, I mean, he'd never opened his mouth, and he was one of the autistic kids. And it was like in February, after having read to him every week, September, October, November, December, January, and I finished, and this little kid said, the end. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that says something about honoring the body. You know, who knows what goes on in the mind and the body of children, even though they seem extremely handicapped, and even though they, you know, seem like it's not doing any good. I don't know what goes on, but I am so thankful that the Lord has given me those children to teach me so much, which they have.
The Book of Henry Nouwens, it's in the bookstore.
Yes.
It's the last book he wrote. was with this handicapped person who didn't say anything.
Yes.
And what it meant to him, I mean, he entered his school ministry with this child who didn't communicate at all.
Yes.
And what a gift it was to him. Mm-hmm. The celebration of that nonverbal person.
Yes. Our daughter volunteered for a year in a L'Arche community in France. I don't know if you're familiar with the Catholic communities called L'Arche, started by Jean Vanier, who some of his books are in the bookstore too. He wanted handicapped people to be able to live in community and not be institutionalized or put away. And so he started communities with two people to begin with in France, and then it grew. And she worked there for a year. And the person to whom she was assigned, it was almost a one-on-one volunteer program, was a young lady who was handicapped from the waist down. She was completely immobile, but she had a water fetish, and she would want to drink water all the time, so when Kristen, our daughter, would bathe her, she would have to soap her body, and then she would have to turn the hose on and give her some water, otherwise she would immediately go down and drink the bath water. She just, you know, had this kind of thing. And I went to France to visit our daughter when she was there, and to sit at table with people whose bodies do not work right is a good experience. One of them spit up everything he ate, and finally the compagnons that they called, the people who worked with them, I mean, they would laugh about it. You know, they'd say, here it comes again, you know, and that would come, you know, and they would simply clean it up and feed him something else. And I thought, what a gift to give these people one-on-one care and to accept the bodies that just aren't working right. They just aren't working right. And yet we can rejoice in the birth of a new baby. Holly and I, like I say, have a new grandson that will be 3 weeks old this week, and I'm sure he's just changed so much in this week I won't even recognize him. But anyway, I just am so thankful to see the miracle of that birth of that baby, and what a blessing that is when God sends a new baby into the world, and how thankful we are. But not all of us are going to be all right. Mm-hmm. And I think part of God's call to us is accept where we are. And if books can help, great.
When Phyllis Stonebuck was here, she does liturgical dance. And one evening up here, she went and got this handicapped child who was only able to work in the laundry and fold the towels and so forth. She went and picked him out of the whole community and had him get up and dance with her.
Oh.
It was absolutely wonderful. Everybody was crying.
Oh, I'm sure.
Just to see that child.
Yes. And so, you know, they sometimes just do such amazing things. We have, at the school where I am, because we have a number of handicapped classes, I have a little first grader who's blind, completely blind, and he walks with this white cane, you know, down the hall. And he has the most cheerful spirit of any little child. And he comes out to me one day, and the kids were lined up this way to check out books, and Tyler's standing right here, and I said, Mrs. Plain, they're kind of noisy. And I said, you know, Tyler, they are. They really are. Do you want me to tell them to be quiet? And I said, well, Tyler, you know, they're not too bad. Let's just let them be. He said, oh, Miss Plain, I just love you. Oh, Tyler, I just love you too. And, you know, he's just this wonderful little spirit that can hear very well, you know. You can't see a thing. But he just goes down the hall, just happy as a lark with his little white cane, you know, in front of him. I think, what a wonderful gift he is to me, you know, to see him content with who he is, even though those eyes aren't going to get any better, and he's only 6 years old, you know, but just such a gift. So rejoice in the day that the Lord has made and in the people he's put there, and celebrate. Thanks so much.
Thank you.